This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine and your host for Trumpet Hour. This is our week in review. We're going to take a survey of important news from all over the world. I have with me here in the studio some of our writing staff, Robert Morley.
Good to be here.
Jeremiah Jacques.
Hello.
Brent Nachtigall.
Hello.
And via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
We're going to start the program today with some big news out of Europe. And for that, I will turn it over to Richard.
Angela Merkel is the Time Person of the Year. This, I'm sure everybody's familiar with, Time magazine surveys world events and picks the one person or group of people they believe who have been most impactful on the events of the past year. And they have picked Angela Merkel. They titled their article Chancellor of the Free World. And it's quite a gushing piece. There are some bits that don't really agree with. We'll get into that later. But I do think it is big news. And it gives us a good opportunity to look back now on how much Germany has changed during Angela Merkel's tenure. And the fact that a German chancellor has been deemed chancellor of the free world and the most influential person of the year, just that alone, without getting into any of the reasons, tells us a lot about Germany's standing in the world. Time wrote that the year 2015 marks the start of Merkel's 10th year as Chancellor of United Germany and the de facto leader of the European Union, the most prosperous joint venture on the planet.
We are talking about liberal journalists at Time magazine. Their reasoning for making this decision would be at least suspect.
Yes, it is full of some pretty gushing praise for Ms. Merkel. It talks about her decision to welcome refugees as the most generous, open-hearted gesture of recent history that blossomed from Germany, the country that within living memory blew apart the European continent and then the world. And it talks about her bold, fraught, immensely empathetic act of leadership in opening the gates of the refugees. So they see her as the person of the year because of her loving, caring decision to open up Germany to refugees and to push Europe to taking the same choice. And so that's their reasoning behind it.
Right. You have to wonder how much of it is an anti-Trump person of the year choice.
I hadn't thought of that actually, but that's probably a good part of it.
But nevertheless, we are talking about people who are observing the world scene, and they recognize Germany's place not only within Europe but within the world as a whole, and here's the woman who's at the helm of that project.
Yes, and I think there's a good point that we can learn from this. Because, you know, at the Trumpet, we're talking a lot and focusing a lot about this strong man that will be coming to Germany. And we know that Merkel is not that strong man. But sometimes in thinking that, we can overlook just how much Germany has changed under Merkel. What an impact, at least the events of her presidency, or her chancellorship, has had. And that really Germany has taken some pretty huge steps over the past 10 years. Now, Deutsche Welle had, and quite a few other German outlets, did have some fairly stinging rebuke for Times' very rosy portrayal of Ms. Merkel, and they're just glossing over completely just about all of the problems that immigration has caused. And they do note that while Time is doing this, in Germany at any rate, the confidence of voters in Angela Merkel decreases rapidly. But we do have an article in our Trumpet Weekly that is very supportive of Times's decision. It's called Merkel's...
Before we get to that, I think it is worth just talking about the response among the German people to the Time magazine honor, the way that they've honored Angela Merkel. The German people really have taken umbrage with that and said that this is really a ridiculous thing for Time to do.
That's right. There has been some positive support for it because she beat the bogeyman, Donald Trump, who is even less popular within the European press than he is among the American. So that's given it, I think, somewhat of a positive spin. But there definitely are people and articles kind of going, well, what in the world? Especially because of the reasoning time used to back it up. You know, they see Europe's borders falling apart. The Schengen Agreement, this, like we talked about before, this one of the biggest achievements of Europe is on the brink of collapse. People are now starting to question, is the European Union going to last? Is it even going to last over the next 12 months, the next few years? There are people genuinely thinking that way. And a lot of the blame points right to Angela Merkel and the way she's handled the migrant crisis. So for Time magazine then to come out and say the way that she's handled the migrant crisis makes her a wonderful person and person of the year really just sounds absurd.
It just shows how out of touch they are with what's actually happening in Europe and the mood within Europe at this point.
Absolutely.
But this article by George Friedman, this really makes a different case for Angela Merkel's receipt of this award.
That's right. It comes to exactly the same conclusion as Time magazine, but uses completely different reasonings. It doesn't even mention the immigration crisis at all. And instead, Friedman in this article, he just focuses on the euro crisis and how Germany's handled it. And that's something we have talked about quite a bit on this program. It talks about how this dilemma that Germany has, how much it relies on the eurozone. Basically, a quarter of its economy is devoted to exporting to the eurozone. So they have a problem here. If Greece leaves and does well, other nations may quit. It will be a catastrophe for Germany. If Germany lets Greece off their debt so that they don't leave, then they'd have to let Spain and Italy off their debts too, and it would also cripple the German economy and be a catastrophe. So Ms. Merkel has really been forced to find a solution to this intractable problem. And her solution was to ferociously, as Friedman put it several times in this article, ferociously bully Greece into making concessions and staying in the euro. And so she would bully Greece into making these concessions, making promises. Greece can't keep these promises. So 2 years down the line, the crisis blows up again. Ms. Merkel has to bully and ferociously bully Greece again into making more promises. And the game just keeps playing out every few years. And so by doing this, though, Ms. Merkel has kind of solved Germany's immediate problems. But as Friedman writes, Merkel has escaped one trap at the pass of passing through a door she never wanted to pass through. The door in which Germany openly managed Europe's affairs and did so with a stick as well as a carrot. And he concludes by writing, Merkel deserved to be named the Times Person of the Year because she has had the greatest impact on the world. Her management of the European economic crisis has led Germany from being an utterly benign power to being an assertive and frightening one. That's not a bad thing for most nations to become, but it's a tough place for Germany to be. Merkel took Germany there, and no one else changed the world more than she did in doing this. And I think he's absolutely right, but that is a big statement. He's saying that Merkel has had a bigger impact on world events than the rise of ISIS and al-Baghdadi or Vladimir Putin or Xi Jinping in China. And he is right, but the rise of an assertive and frightening, as he put it, Germany is a huge story. And it is the story that will probably have the biggest consequences of all of the events from this year now going forward.
That is really remarkable because those other individuals that you mentioned, ISIS and Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, they're getting recognition for the dangers that they pose by a lot of people. Nobody's looking at Merkel as any kind of I guess you could say the Greeks probably do, but she's not getting nearly the negative press for turning Germany more in a more aggressive posture the way that some of those others are.
No, I mean, maybe there were a few headlines right around the time of the Greek crisis, but who remembers the Greek crisis now? There have been so many other crises within Europe with the immigration crisis, with the Paris attacks. Everyone's forgotten about that. You did have just a flicker of outrage, especially among the left, for example, in Britain, kind of expressing solidarity with Greece and standing up to Germany. But it's gone now. It's forgotten. There were some people expressing concerns and now they're not. There's no sustained focus on this problem. And so really what you've got is Merkel she's done a really dangerous combination. She has presided over this resurgence of German power and German domination in Europe. And then at the same time with the euro crisis now is starting to bring about a catastrophe that would make Germans crave to put a very strong leader in what is now, thanks to Merkel, a very powerful position, Chancellor of Germany.
Yeah, and it's interesting, I guess, the other point that Friedman makes is just how much the other European countries whose economies are struggling and who were basically going the route that Greece was taking, they had to step in line when they recognized just what a tough line Merkel was taking. And so their relationship with Germany has fundamentally changed because of the way that Merkel handled this situation, and that's just cemented Germany's position within this European project as a whole.
Absolutely. I mean, you just look, maybe 5 years ago, everybody talked about Merkozy leading Europe, this kind of combined France and Germany, Sarkozy and Merkel. Nobody talks about Merkozy, well, Mollande, I guess, whatever you would, however you would portmontage those two names together. But nobody talks about Franco-Germany leading Europe. Mm. It is very clearly Germany. And that is a change that took place under Angela Merkel, and it's a big part of that change with the way they ferociously bullied Greece over the summer. That's a major part of that change took place this year.
Fascinating stuff. Well, let's go ahead and move on right into the headlines, the overview from Europe, if you wouldn't mind giving that to us, Richard.
Well, one of the biggest pieces of news from Europe is how well the far right, the National Front, did in France last weekend. We spoke about this at more detail on Wednesday, but they're now the most popular party in France. It was a record-breaking election for them. The next round of these elections will be on Sunday, and that will determine whether they actually win control of any of these 13 regions that they'll be voting in. They may not do all that well. It does look like the voters from all the other parties are ganging up on them, but opinion polls have been pretty unreliable of late, so it'll be very interesting to see how they do. But regardless, really, of how well they do on Sunday, they already are the most popular party. And that is going to make an impact, no matter the results of Sunday's elections. And we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly on this. It's called Judy Asks, Is Marine Le Pen Stoppable? And she asked a few different web experts across Europe. One of these experts talked about how both Marine Le Pen and her niece are portraying themselves as modern Joan of Arcs, rescuing the French Republic from Muslims as much as from the Euro. And so as you get this immigration crisis, you can really see the influence of these women and of Le Pen growing. The other, another big piece of news is we had German planes arrived in Turkey yesterday to start running their mission against Syria. Germany also announced that they're going to increase the number of troops they have in Afghanistan by another 100 or so, from about 850 to a bit over 950. So while other nations have in the past been drawing down, Germany is still there and increasing their deployment. Iraq has asked Germany for more help this week, so maybe we'll see some action there. And then Poland has said that his country, or a Polish official has said that his country is thinking about asking for some of America's nuclear weapons under NATO's nuclear sharing plan. Other officials have denied this, but it's interesting that you've got this discussion, and it shows how unstable Poland feels right now.
Okay, and your number one story from Europe.
Number one story from Europe is we have an article in the Trumpet Weekly called Slippery Slope, Are German Ground Troops Inevitable in Syria? And this is from Der Spiegel magazine, and it makes a really interesting point. Firstly, it just makes the point that now that German air raids are going on, or Germany is participating in the air war against Syria, that increases the potential for ground troops to go into Syria. German government is not allowed to send, or they've not asked to send ground troops in. They're not saying they're sending ground troops in, but also they've not denied that it's a possibility in the future. They've kind of given these non-committal answers. It's not in this article, but on an article on our website, there's a quote from a top German general that talked about how at the moment sending ground troops into Syria is a red line. But then he said, we know these days we see how quickly red lines can be crossed with everything going on in Europe with the terrorist attacks, etc. So there's the option, there's the potential that this crisis could just draw Germany more into Syria and you could see ground troops in that way. There's also the potential for a German plane to be shot down, which would then mandate ground troops to go in and rescue. And Germany said they prefer to do that rather than rely on the American special forces. But the thing that I thought was really interesting is this article raised the point that if there's some kind of peace deal in Syria, even if ISIS aren't defeated, but if they can come to some kind of agreement with Assad, then Germany would feel obligated probably to send ground troops in and to be part of that peace mission. It writes that German participation in a ground force would be very likely in the event of a ceasefire in Syria. It talked about, it wrote, were Germany to back away from sending ground troops, the US and France would not likely show much understanding, particularly given how often Steinmeier and Defense Minister Ursula von der Leyen have spoken in recent years about wanting Germany to take on a greater role in the international community. And this is a fascinating idea. And we've talked about at the Trumpet a fair bit how Bible prophecy says that Syria will end up in this Psalm 83 alliance, this alliance of Muslim countries that is allied with Germany and with the European Union. And we're not entirely sure how that's happened, and we've kind of how that will end up, and we've kind of scratched our heads and come up with a few different ways as to how this could happen, and it's hard to see exactly where it will go now. But this would be one way that could pan out, if there's some kind of peace deal, and then you end up with Germany and then other European Union forces playing a major role on the ground in Syria. So given how reluctant Germany is typically to send troops abroad, I think it's very interesting now that there is this conversation about ground troops in Syria.
That whole theater is just really interesting to watch. We were talking on the program on Wednesday about Russia's influence there, and Turkey's influence, and how it's having its way there. And now for Germany to be helping out the way that it is, there's just a whole lot of great powers that are all involved in getting kind of tangled up in ways that it's hard to see exactly how this is going to unfold, but it certainly does have great prophetic implications.
I think if it weren't for those prophecies, we'd probably just have to hold up our hands and say we have no idea how this is going to unfold, which I think is what a lot of commentators are doing right now. It does change so fast, just like Putin, you know, when one day Russia gets involved, suddenly the situation's completely different. So it will be fascinating to see how it plays out.
Interesting stuff, Richard. You're listening to our Week in Review program, looking at the big stories from around the world this past week. We're going to move now to the Middle East. This top story actually links right in with what we've been talking about with Richard. Brent, I'd like to just go straight to your top story.
Okay, the top story I have in the Middle East is from Bloomberg View, and it's titled, Western Officials Say Iran is Retreating from Syria Fight, and that is by Eli Lake. Now, it details that the journalist has uncovered that a bunch of U.S. officials have been saying lately that they've seen significant numbers of Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps troops retreat from certain Syrian combat zones in recent weeks. Now, this comes after there has been a lot of injuries to top officials inside Syria, Iranian officials. There's even been rumors that Qassem Soleimani, the leader of the Quds force, might have been injured. He hasn't shown up on the battlefield for a number of weeks. So it looks like that Iran, since Iran is losing many of its troops there, they might have decided to pull some of their ground forces out of Syria. Now, we'll remember that the goal of Russian flyovers or Russian air power and then was meant to be combined with Iranian, Syrian, Hezbollah-supported ground troops. That was the goal. That's what the goal was when Soleimani went up to Russia and said to Putin, please get involved. You supply the air power, we'll supply the ground forces, and we can get this thing won inside Syria. Now, there have been reports that Putin originally was told that this would probably take about 3 months to be in and out of Syria. And yet what we've seen is 3 months after September, or almost 3 months fully after September, we have seen pretty much a stalemate. There hasn't been much success on the battlefield in Syria. You've had over 4,000 sorties by Russian aircraft inside Syria since they got involved there. And yet, what territory have they taken back? The main territory they're trying to take back is the Idlib province. That's right on the western part of Syria, bordering on Turkey to the north. And that's the same area that where the Turkish jet shot down the Russian fighter a couple of weeks ago. And most of these ground forces have been located there trying to beat back the Syrian rebels, but they haven't had much success in that.
Well, that's interesting. So what does this mean? We've talked so much about just how close the alliance has been for so long between Syria and Iran. For Iran to essentially be conceding to some degree, I mean, it's hard to say, I guess, exactly to what degree, but pulling back and, you know, limiting its commitment to that theater, what does this mean?
Well, I think Obviously, Iran wants Syria in its back pocket. It still wants the leadership of Bashar al-Assad to be in power so that it can exert its will over Syria, so that it can still maintain that land bridge all the way to Lebanon. So it's not giving up by pulling out. It probably sees that they're losing too many men, so they're going to have to retreat for a little bit. But I don't see this as a point which Iran is giving up in Syria at all. They might see that there's other ways to get to their conclusion or their goal of keeping Assad in power. And obviously they would make these decisions in conjunction with Russia. So they might think that there's still a way to make it happen. And what's interesting is maybe Iran feels like, you know, there is a place for other supporters to come in and help wage that ground war. But we'll see. I mean, we've obviously talked about that. You talked about that with Richard, just the proposition of other ground forces coming in against the fight in Syria against the Islamic State. And maybe Iran, looking at the long game, feels like any other power that does come in will probably go home. There'll be a peacekeeping power. Iran is patient. As long as they can get some international consensus that Assad should stay in power or the regime will be able to continue, if there's an international declaration supporting Russia's mission, supporting what the Iranians have done, keeping Assad in power, I don't think Iran will be too disappointed at leaving. And I don't think they'll be too disappointed at seeing other ground forces from other countries, maybe European countries, come in there and help out maintain that peace. They still get their way. They still get their guy, but they're not losing the men. Now, this plan, if it comes about like that, we expect it to backfire, because maybe those ground forces that do come in there as part of supporting this mission, in the future, maybe they intend to hang around a little bit longer than Iran might think.
Yeah, like we were talking about with Richard, it is a really complicated situation. And if it weren't for the overview that we have with biblical prophecy, like Richard said, there's just most people who are looking at this are kind of just throwing up their hands and saying, well, we don't know exactly what direction this is going or what to expect in the time ahead. But yeah, we know that there's going to be a divide between this Iran-Syrian alliance, and we've been looking for Assad's fall. We've been looking for a real change in the status quo in Syria to precipitate that divide. So, you know, it's not difficult to see how Iran kind of losing heart, or at least redirecting the strategy that's been pursuing in Syria, could play into that kind of a scenario.
Right. Again, this is not a change in their desire or their goal to maintain their ally in Assad in power in Syria. They are just—they're up against a hard place. Iran is very strong in will, and very strong in their determined effort to bring about their goals through terrorist acts and things like that. But they can't project their power in the form of ground forces, I think, as much as we might assume. So this is going to come about. We know the biblical prophecy is going to take place there in Syria, and just maybe Iran's weakening power in Syria might bring about that.
You know, the one other question that I have is, to what degree is Russia's strategy in Syria predicated on an Iranian ground troop presence, and how much does Iran pulling back kind of leave Russia isolated, and, you know, and does it compromise Russia's ability to exert its will in that theater?
I think you're right. I think it does very much so. Russia hasn't want to put boots on the ground in Syria. They've been happy to use their air force. It's a little bit safer and probably not as much energies.
Well, we were talking with Robert earlier about just the possibility, or the reports of Russia establishing a base there, or two or three, and kind of digging in for a longer term presence there.
Yeah, I think there's no doubt about it. Russia is looking to fill the power void that the United States is leaving, as, you know, we've been very overt in the fact that we want out of the Middle East, we want out of Iraq, U.S. wants out of the region in general. And Russia looks at this as an opportunity. But as Brent's saying, as far as Syria goes, how committed does Russia want to be to putting boots on the ground? And I think Brent's right. I don't think it does want to have that kind of commitment there.
So, yeah, like we were talking about with Richard, we're looking at a situation where Germany could very well end up having a presence in Syria, maybe as part of a larger peacekeeping outfit or some kind of a resolution in order to enforce a ceasefire or that type of
thing.
Yeah,
and I just don't think that the Russians would be too upset by that. The Iranians wouldn't be upset by that proposition. Who are the Germans? We remember what they've done in numerous wars in the 20th century, but that was a long time ago. So I don't think that would welcome German involvement because they probably would think it's not going to last.
It's a very interesting situation, and it seems like the plot thickens weekly. Before we break here, I want to just give you the opportunity, Brent, to give us the overview of the rest of the headlines from the Middle East.
Well, since I'm almost out of time here, I'll just shoot one by you, and that is that the Russia and Turkey relations continue to sour. The Russian United Nations ambassador told the UN Security Council on Tuesday that Turkey was acting recklessly and inexplicably by sending troops across the border into Iraq without the consent of the government. Now, these Turkish troops that are going over into Iraq, they're going to the northern areas of Iraq that is under Kurdish control, not the strongest Iraqi government control there. And I find it slightly hypocritical that the Russian government is concerned about Turkey going in there without the consent of the government. You can ask the Ukrainians how they feel about that, what took place last year.
Right. Well, thank you, Brent. These articles we're talking about are in this week's Trumpet Weekly. This is a high-quality report that we produce every week with the most significant stories from around the world. I'd like to encourage you to subscribe to this free weekly news report. If you just go online, you can find it on thetrumpet.com and subscribe to the Trumpet Weekly. Coming up, we're going to look at important news from Asia and Anglo-America. Later on in the program, we'll have our lightning round of headlines from all our panelists. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to look now at Asia, and Jeremiah Jacques will start with the overview.
Well, Russia and China's anti-satellite weapons pose a serious risk to the United States. That was the assessment this week by U.S. General John Hyten. Hyten is the commander of the Air Force's Space Command, and he said that Americans are still, you know, under the assumption that space is sort of a benign environment in terms of geopolitics here on Earth. But he said that is not the world we live in anymore, and Americans need to recognize that space is now a contested environment.
Right, because of the dominance of satellites and how central they are to fighting war. We have an article about that in the coming Trumpet by Richard Palmer, the one that we're putting together this week and next. Really important subject.
Yes, they could really handicap us by taking out some of those satellites. And then we had another story here from December 9th, just showing that Russia is really flexing its military muscles. It launched a strike in Syria from submarines stationed in the Mediterranean. So this was the very first time it's ever launched strikes from that position. And it just shows that Russia is ratcheting up its bombing campaign there in the war-torn country. And to me, it shows that Russia is really digging its heels into this conflict.
Very interesting. So just out of curiosity, it would route its subs through the Bosporus and through Turkish waters, basically, to get into the Mediterranean.
Yeah, that's right. And there were some cargo vessels earlier this week that were actually detained by Turkish officials, just as we see this tension between Russia and Turkey rising. They detained four different Russian cargo vessels, three of them just for a few hours, but one for quite a bit of time. So it shows that Turkey could have some real leverage in that way over the Russian Navy.
And your top story for this week from Asia?
The top story is that China and Russia are gearing up to use their veto power to prevent the United Nations from punishing North Korea for its human rights abuses. North Korea under leader Kim Jong-un is the world's most brutal dictator. That's really saying a lot in this world of just so much brutality. But it's true. His government operates an intricate network of political prisons and work camps, and it's responsible for so much abuse and enslavement and just systematic torture, forced starvation, rape and murder. It's a really diabolical government that needs to be punished. And the United Nations wants to pass some punitive measures against that government because of all those abuses. The UN's punitive measures fall really short of the kind of solution that would actually end all that suffering in North Korea, but it is a start. But the trouble is Russia and China. So the United Nations Security Council has 5 permanent members: the United States, Great Britain, France, and then Russia and China. And all 5 of these have what are called veto rights. That means that anything the UN wants to do to a certain nation or another entity, these 5 have the power to stop it. And when the United Nations says it's time to punish North Korea, as it has several times over the last few years, Russia and China are always quick to step up and play that veto card. These nations have the same anti-Western agenda as North Korea. They benefit from cheap North Korean slave labor. They like having North Korea as kind of a distraction so that they themselves have a little more leeway to really maneuver themselves into positions of power and just push against the U.S.-led model of stability that's governed the world for so long. So it's not hard to understand why Russia and China want to keep the United Nations from punishing North Korea. But what is hard to understand is why the United Nations gives them the power to do that. What good is this organization, the United Nations, that's supposed to be about bringing peace to the world, if it gives veto power to countries that want anything but peace? What good is it if it gives power to countries like Russia and China, who repeatedly use their veto power to prevent the United Nations from really accomplishing anything that would help the oppressed peoples of the world? The United Nations was formed back in 1945, right at the end of World War II there, and it was formed as a peace effort to prevent future wars and to prevent brutality. But it has failed spectacularly at those goals. Since its inception in 1945, there have been at least 280 wars and more than 3,000 other military conflicts. And if you total all the casualties up from all of those conflicts, it totals just about as many deaths as people who died in World War II itself. So it's easy to see that the United Nations has been a colossal and embarrassing failure.
You're not suggesting that eliminating the veto right of those Security Council nations would solve the problems of the United Nations, but rather that the fact that they are capable of basically stonewalling against any action being taken shows just the fundamental flaw in the institution itself.
Yeah, that's right. It's flawed at its very core. It's really been an enabler of oppression and of conflict, and that's largely just because of its rank corruption. And I think probably the most fascinating aspect of this trend, the failure and the corruption of the United Nations, is that there was one analyst who recognized from the beginning that the United Nations would be not just a failure at keeping the peace, but even a catalyst to conflict. And that was a world-renowned educator, Herbert W. Armstrong. He was there at the first meeting that the UN ever had back in 1945. And I just wanted to read a short quote that he spoke at that first meeting. He said, "Already I see the clouds of World War III gathering at this conference. I do not see peace being germinated here, but the seeds of the next war." It's really amazing to me that he was able to see from the very beginning that the UN would not and could not bring peace to this world.
Right. It's really predicated on just a fundamental understanding of the reality of human nature. And the idea that, say, a global body, if you just get enough people together in a room and they're able to talk these things out, that they're going to be able to propose a solution to the problems and the conflicts in the world that would eliminate human nature, or that would be above the problems that human nature creates. But really, it's just people can't govern themselves. They can't create solutions to these things because we created the problems to begin with.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The way of peace we know not. You know, the United Nations is a really stark example of that. And it's just clear in headlines like the one from this week that Russia and China are blocking the measures to try to, you know, punish that North Korean government, that it is just a terrible failure.
It's kind of a macrocosmic view of the problems with governments all over the place. Right now, we're dealing with a political climate in the United States that's extremely divided. You have different competing parties that are have extremely different goals and are bumping up against one another, and it's causing a lot of gridlock and preventing things from being done, and it's certainly not solving problems. You just blow that up to the global scale, and to think that a Russia and a China and a United States and a Britain and a France would be able to come together and create solutions to some of the big problems in the world, it really is pretty ludicrous when you think about it. You're listening to our Week in Review program. We're going to move now to Anglo-America and Robert Morley. Let's start with the overview, Robert.
Sure, I'd be happy to. So Russia's central bank announced that it was including the Chinese yuan into the central bank's official reserves for the first time. Taking a look at Russia's reserves at its central bank, currently they stand at 44% being held in U.S. dollars. So this decision to start including the yuan in its reserves are being seen by analysts as the first step in reducing, or another step in reducing, the dollar component. To me, what's interesting about this is it shows just how much of the world still uses the U.S. dollar, relies on it heavily. Even America's enemies like Russia still have to keep 44% of their reserves in U.S. dollars. But it also shows, you know, that the dollar has such a dominant role that as the world shifts from that, and we see it shifting, there will be some big impacts on America, America's economy, and the dollar. This report by the Eastern Outlook also noted that Russia's been adding to its official gold reserves very dramatically. Their gold reserves are up 129% over the past 2 years. Also, nearly half of youth in the United States now say the American dream is dead. A nationwide survey released Thursday by Harvard's University Institute of Politics shows that almost half of those aged 18 to 29 believe that the American dream is more dead than alive. One interesting bit about this poll was that race and ethnicity of the poll's respondents didn't significantly impact the results. So we're seeing this across every race in America. One thing that did impact the results was education level. Those who had higher education seem to think that things were better than those that had lower education.
How did they define the American dream?
They just basically asked the question, do you believe the American dream is more dead or more alive, or something along those lines?
The definition is in the eyes of the
absolutely
respondent.
There could be many different reasons why people believe it's dead or alive, and even conflicting. And
But generally, or
people are dissatisfied.
Definitely shows a discontent in the United States. All right, your top story for Anglo-America.
Okay, the top story this week is that Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula released a new video. And lo and behold, it's featuring a former Guantanamo Bay detainee, a man named Ibrahim Qusi, who is also known as Sheikh Sudani. This man has now become a leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen. This was a guy that was held for many, many years in Guantanamo because he was considered so dangerous. But back in 2010, Qusi pleaded guilty to charges of conspiracy and material support for terrorism. And that plea was part of a deal in which he agreed to cooperate, quote unquote, with prosecutors. And because he cooperated with them, he was able to cut a deal and they sent him home back to Sudan in 2012. Now authorities say that Qusi has joined up with Al-Qaeda. And just 2 years later, he has now been shooting up through the ranks of Al-Qaeda, and he's now considered one of their leaders. In this video that they released, he and other Al-Qaeda commanders are just bragging about waging jihad against the West. They call themselves the Guardians of Sharia. And as you recall, you probably know, Sharia is this term for Islamic law. It's a form of law that many, even moderate Muslims, ascribe to. They brought Sharia law to many nations around the world, the United States, Britain, and elsewhere. There's parts of London today that the police don't go. They leave the governing to basically the Muslim authorities in that area. Sharia law is the de facto government in these areas. Now, women who don't dress the proper way are accosted. Financial activity in some of these areas are governed by Islamic rules. The schools teach Islamic principles, etc.
Now, you got to be careful about making assertions like this, Robert, or that somebody might start a petition to exclude you from being able to enter Britain.
Well, you know, People do have to be careful about that. There's been people who have been put on no-fly lists for books they've written. For example, I'm criticizing Sharia law. I've been put on no-fly zones. Mark Stein, I think, was kept out of Britain for a while because of a book he wrote about that and others. So you're right about that, actually. But in this video, Kosi here, he's talking about how Islamic scholars are ensuring the correctness of this jihadist product. And it's basically a recruitment video in many ways. But they just come across as so confident that other individuals in countries around the world, the United States, Britain, etc., will continue on the fight. They'll rise up and enact more San Bernardino-type attacks in these countries. The video celebrates jihadists that have done these sort of things, the Charlie Hebdo attacks, etc. And just looking at what they're saying, you can see that they fully believe that they're able to carry out these kind of attacks in the United States and Britain and elsewhere. And this was a guy, you know, the sad part about this is a guy that we had in Guantanamo. We knew he was evil. Now, after this video came out, there were some reports that were leaked about his interrogation while he was there. And this guy was a radical. This was not some repentant guy that was sad of what he did. This is somebody that should not have been released, at least according to the documents that were released. This was a guy that had direct contact with Osama bin Laden. He communicated with him directly. There aren't too many people who actually did that. They had to go through third parties. But this guy...
Except for CNN reporters.
Well, yeah, I guess... Yeah, I won't say too much about what side the CNN reporters are on, perhaps. Anyway, I mean, this guy, though...
We had him. We knew what he was about. Right. We let him go, and here he is. When you're watching an Al-Qaeda propaganda video, it's got to be a little bit disheartening to recognize somebody in the video as a guy that you had in prison at one point.
Right. It makes you wonder this whole concept of releasing these detainees. If you look at how many of them have been reactivated, have come back into fighting, there's dozens. There's dozens that have been there, have been released. You know, we sent them to other places, Ecuador, whatever country will take them because we don't want to put them in the system, and they're back fighting America.
Well, two thoughts that I have about this are, one is that we just don't hear about Al-Qaeda. The Islamic State has done such a good job of ripping the headlines and drawing all of the attention, but how big of a threat is Al-Qaeda now? Do you have any idea?
There's certainly still a threat. I think that even in this video, you saw that Al-Qaeda, in a sense, was worried about ISIS. I think they are feeling the drain as some supporters that would normally be supporting Al-Qaeda have been shifting to ISIS. And some of the statements they make in that video are tended to say that their version of radical Islam is the correct one. It's more doctrinally correct than, you know, the ISIS is. But from threat assessments that are produced by the United States government, they're still very clear about the threat Al-Qaeda poses.
The other thing is, I just wonder, what would it take for this administration in Washington to acknowledge the failure in their eagerness to let these hardcore extremists go?
They won't. I don't think they will. If you look at some of the arguments they make, some of them sound quite reasonable. But I think once you start really drilling down, you see some of the problems with those. So, for example, they say Guantanamo is one of the biggest recruiting tools for people like ISIS.
Right.
So they say, you know, well,
everything that we do against these people is a recruiting tool.
Well, exactly. I mean, we're fighting a war against them. I mean, that in itself is a recruiting tool, right? So as if Guantanamo is going to be a bigger recruiting tool. But I mean, these are some of the excuses that they have for shutting it down.
Well, I've seen the Islamic State recruiting video, and it didn't mention the fact that we were being tough against them as being a reason to go on their side. It was how weak the United States is, how weak the West is. Those were the talking points in their recruitment video. So I don't know if somebody needs to pay attention. Well, remember, you can find us online at thetrumpet.com, so you can go there to receive a free subscription to this weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. The stories that we're talking about on the program today are in this week's edition. We'll finish up the program next with our lightning round of important news from all our panelists. That's coming up next.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
It's time now for our lightning round. We're going to take one last look at some of the headlines from this week that caught our attention, starting with Richard.
Britain is no longer a Christian country and should stop acting as if it is. That was the conclusion of a major inquiry into the place of religion in modern society. There was a conclusion of a two-year commission that spent chaired by a former judge. It involved people like the ex-archbishop, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. They spent the last 2 years looking at the role of religion in society, and they've concluded that Britain is not a Christian country anymore. And so instead of kind of having this official religion of the Church of England, there should be a new settlement. And so this committee recommended things like completely stripping all Christian religious elements out of the coronation ceremony. Now, this is a ceremony that the earliest known recorded ceremony all the way back in the mid 9th century, I believe it was, had the choir singing Zadok the Priest. It's not the same Handel version that we know today, but they were singing at Edgar's coronation ceremony a version of Zadok the Priest. It fundamentally is a Christian ceremony and always has been as long as we've got any record of it. And they want to, this commission wants to get rid of all of that. They've also concluded that they want to make it clear that, or they want students to be able to talk about Muslim extremism in school. They want students to be able to speak extremist ideology in schools and in colleges and not have to worry that they'll be reported to the police. They want them to have the ability to spread radical Islamism in schools. They want to take the bishops out of the House of Lords, and they want to have rabbis and imams as well in there. So it's a really striking document. In a way, they're right. Britain has de-Christianized itself a lot, but it's basically demanding constitutional vandalism in the name of political correctness.
Just so that I understand, they're saying get rid of the Christian elements, but empower the non-Christian religious elements?
Well, put them on equal footing. So I guess rather than completely eliminating the bishops, radically scale back on them and then bring in others as well. So you kind of have this equality of religion rather than one official religion.
It's an amazing story, Richard. And now on to Brent.
Iran has test-fired another mid-range ballistic missile, and this is in violation of United Nations Security Council resolutions. This is the second one that they've fired since the July nuclear deal was concluded. Now, this missile that they fired, they test-fired, is capable of carrying a nuclear warhead up to 1,200 miles as well. And yet, the reaction for this action from the United States has been quite weak. They've said that they'll be looking into it. And then one of the reporters asked, well, are you still looking into the first one as well? That was reported a couple of months ago. And we have an article inside the Trumpet Weekly here about this. It's called Iran Flouts One Rule, Why Not All? It's from Commentary Magazine. And I'll just quote it here. It says, the problem here isn't so much these particular missiles, although they do pose a potential lethal threat both to Israel and moderate Arab nations in the region. Rather, it's the precedent that has been set by an American refusal to take Iran's violations of these agreements seriously. If small rules were broken, then big ones would follow, as the Islamist regime tested U.S. forbearance for cheating. They cheated on one of these really specific rules from the United Nations that you shall not fire ballistic missiles, test them or develop them, and yet nothing has happened. So if they're going to cheat in the small ways, why not cheat with a bigger program such as their nuclear weapons program?
Yeah, it definitely tests the legitimacy of the deal that we made with them overall.
Right. Who's going to slap their hands in the future?
Thank you, Brent. We'll move now to Jeremiah.
Well, a major meeting took place this week between the members of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. That's normally called the SCO. This organization was founded back in 2001, and it consists of Russia, China, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan. And then India and Pakistan have recently started the process of becoming members. So at this meeting on December 7th, these powerful Asian nations discussed ways to strengthen military cooperation. So for students of Bible prophecy, that should really catch our attention. Back in the year 90 AD, the Apostle John recorded a prophecy describing an army of 200 million men, which is far more people than were even alive at that time on all of Earth. So now, though, if you look at the populations of these SCO nations, together, it's far north of 3 billion people. So it's not hard to see how such a massive army of 200 million could come about. So the SCO is an important organization for us to keep an eye on. It really seems like Russia and China are the regional powers who are driving the rise of the Eastern nations, but the SCO seems to be one of the vehicles that they're using to accomplish that.
Very interesting, and we'll move on to Robert.
Well, the Chinese yuan has fallen to its lowest level in 5 years against the dollar, and if China decides that it needs to devalue its currency like many of its neighbors, then the Telegraph's Ambrose Evans Pritchard is warning that it will be an economic earthquake. So while the world here is looking at hanging on Janet Yellen's every word, wondering if the Federal Reserve will raise interest rates, Pritchard's warning that there could be an even greater danger lurking. And he says a greater risk over the next coming months is that China stops trying to hold the line against devaluation and it goes ahead and devalues. And he says if this happens, it'll send a shockwave of deflation through the global economy. So there's this big fear in the world that China might have to join all these other Asian nations that have been devaluating, trying to steal trade from each other, trying to get their economies going. And now China looks like it's in trouble as well. Commodity prices are collapsing. China is not importing iron ore or coal anymore. The factories are slowing down. Ships are sitting empty. Global trade is slowing down. And China's been holding the line, he says. And he says even part of this deal to include China in the SDR, the IMF currency basket, might have been throwing them a bone, say, hey, don't devalue because this is going to impact them. If you do this, then we're in trouble. And China's one of our biggest trade partners. If they devalue, that's going to hit American manufacturers in the gut. And that could be the tipping point, Pritchard says, for the global economy.
Remarkable that China has that power.
The world revolves around China. It's the manufacturing house of the world.
So we put ourselves in this position where we're kind of beholden to what move China makes in this situation. And it's pretty scary.
Absolutely.
Well, I wanted to finish with the fact that on November 20th, the UN Security Council Resolution 2249 passed unanimously. It says that the Islamic State poses a, quote, unprecedented threat to international peace and security. Unprecedented. You also have people saying that this terrorist group is going to be around for a while. For example, Barack Obama said the fight against the Islamic State will be a long-term campaign. Well, Daniel Pipes published a little item that we have in this week's Trumpet Weekly where he says, permit me to disagree strenuously on both counts. I'll just read this to you. On the first, ISIS is not exactly the equivalent of Nazi Germany. It's a little bug that the powers could quash at will if they put their mind to it. It survives only because no one really takes it seriously enough to fight with ground troops, the only gauge of an intention to prevail. On the second point, between its alienation of its subject population and its gratuitous and unrestrained violence toward foreign countries, ISIS has made enemies of nearly everyone. Recent days alone have seen attacks on three powerful states, Turkey, the bombing in Ankara, Russia, the airliner over Sinai, and France, the attacks in Paris. This is not a path for survival. Friendless and despised, its every success shortens its life. Contrary to other analysts, I, Daniel Pipes, foresee that ISIS will disappear without warning and as abruptly as it arose. This could follow on some combination of internal revolt, internecine feuds, economic collapse, and external attack. And when that happy day comes, we can all focus on the real, quote, unprecedented threat to international peace and security, unquote, namely nuclear weapons in the hands of Iran's apocalyptic leadership. I'm Joel Hilliker. We're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Look us up online at thetrumpet.com. We'll be happy to give you a free subscription to our weekly news report, The Trumpet Weekly. All the stories we've talked about on the program are in this week's edition. We'd love to hear from you. Email us at letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Richard Palmer, Brent Noctegal, Jeremiah Jacques, and Robert Morley.
Great to be here.
Thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondeau. And I'll leave you with the words of Malcolm Forbes. If you have a job without aggravations, you don't have a job. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on The Voice, 101.3 KPCG, and on the web at kpcg.fm.